Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
The great Billie Holiday with God Bless the Child. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, September the 26th, and we'll be talking today about America's great economic divide, which our guest says is born out of racial inequality and is likely to be so for generations to come, unless we really get serious and do something about it. Our guest is Professor Thomas Shapiro, who directs the Institute on Assets and Social Policy and is the Pocross Professor of Law and Social Policy at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. A leader in the field of asset development, his primary areas of focus and research are in racial inequality and public policy and closing the wealth gap. Professor Shapiro has written prolifically on these subjects, including the books Black Wealth, White Wealth, A New Perspective on Racial Inequality with Dr. Melvin Oliver, Great Divides, Readings in Social Inequality in the United States, The Hidden Cost of Being African American, How Wealth Perpetuates Inequality, and Population Control Politics, Women, Sterilization, and Reproductive Choice. Professor Shapiro, thank you for being with us today.
It is my pleasure to have the chance to talk to you again.
Thanks. It's been a while, quite a while. Census figures released this week indicate that America's poverty rate for 2011 at 15.9% increased from the previous year's 15.3%. By total numbers, about 48.5 million people remained below the poverty line last year, that is, with an annual income of $23,021 or less for a family of four. It was the highest poverty rate in more than half a century. And while unemployment eased slightly between 2010 and 2011, the gap between rich and poor increased, according to the census figures released. I know you'll be studying the data in greater depth, Professor Shapiro, but from your vantage point, with your expertise, what are these figures beginning to suggest to you?
I think we see two trends that have clearly come together. First, the poverty line data that now includes at least 48.5 million families, and of course we would be remiss if we didn't just throw out there the idea that the official government poverty line, many social scientists believe, is a vast underestimate of what's really going on. But nonetheless, it gives us a figure of 15.9% under that official government poverty line. And that is the first trend that is clearly a consequence, and we hope not a lasting consequence, but right now it is a consequence of the Great Recession. It is the lasting collateral damage about the destruction of jobs, the demeaning of work, the way in which wages for those that have not been able to work, that have been able to work, have not risen at all, and the reduced working hours for basically all families. And that's what that figure is telling us. The slight paradox, of course, is that the official unemployment rate actually trickled down a little bit from the last time we had seen it. And it seems, of course, that it doesn't compute. How can the poverty rate be going up but the unemployment rate ticking downward slightly? The answer to that, as other data from the Labor Department tells us very clearly, is that we've been in the recession long enough now such that workers have become very discouraged and have stopped looking for work. And those people that have stopped looking for work because they've been beating down doors and nothing's come their way with a very high unemployment rate, those individuals and those families no longer, quote-unquote, count in the official tally that we see in the unemployment rate. So it's not like more people are employed. More people are employed, but we, with the demographics tell us we need to add a little over 100,000 jobs a month just to keep pace. That's a big job growth machine that needs to get ratcheted up in the United States. So those jobs are increasing, but we're not at the point yet where we're above that line enough so the real unemployment rate can come down. And when that unemployment rate comes down, most assuredly, soon thereafter, the poverty rate is going to follow and also trend downward.
When these figures come out, and we're told that this is what the unemployment rate and so forth, your brain works very differently with these numbers. How do you compute these numbers? What do you look for?
In there's official statistics, and there are alternative metrics that the Department of Labor uses, for example, to measure unemployment. And I don't want to get into the so-called policy weeds or get too wonky about this, but the Department of Labor actually, if you go into their website and look up the unemployment data, the official figure is there, but they also give us alternatives. And the alternatives, for example, will add those discouraged workers. And there's another figure that will add people that are vastly underemployed. That is, people working part-time but are looking for full-time work and have not been able to find it. And those figures are, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but they're considerably larger than the official unemployment rate. Similarly, we have alternative ways of looking at the poverty level in the United States. The poverty level, the official government one we look at, is something that was an incredibly great innovation when it was introduced in 1964, I believe it was, out of the Department of Agriculture, which essentially used the calibrated the poverty level to a family's food budget, a minimum standard of a food budget, and multiplied that by three, and that's still where that official poverty line comes from. The National Academy of Sciences some years ago commissioned the social science community to come up with some alternatives to that, for example, look at the median or the real expenses of families compared to their needs. And when we look at figures like that, the poverty rate is about a magnitude of about 25% to 50% higher than the official rate that we quoted at the top of the show of 15.9%. So it's a matter of sort of understanding the strengths and the weaknesses of those official government data sources and knowing where the real alternatives are and how to sort of parse that in your head about what's really going on.
But however one interprets it, you say, and you've been saying this consistently in your writings and in your research and your areas of focus, that the poverty is, one, persistent, and two, multi-generational, and three, race-based.
That's,
could you explain?
Yes, that's correct. Let me provide a little context to the way I think about that. The official government poverty line is really good when it is about income only. But income is really only a part of the story. It's a good part of the story, but there are chapters in that story that are left unexamined by only looking at income. Because economic security for a family is not just about income, which is very important, but it's also about that set of stored resources they have, what we call wealth. the money they have put aside in a savings account. Perhaps if you're fortunate, in some stocks and bonds, in an individual retirement account, all of the different kinds of financial vehicles and instruments that are not, that go beyond income. It's that storehouse of resources that families use for both contingencies, emergencies, and that families really use when they plan for their own mobility. When they ask the question, how do we move ahead? It's largely about wealth. It's largely about those stored resources. And so when we add the wealth and financial asset capacity of a household, subtracting their debts from their assets, we have a very different story about what the poverty line looks like. For example, if we were not to look at income as the basis of the poverty line, but to sort of change that lane and ask what's the poverty line if we look at family wealth, the figures are not 15.9%, it's closer to 33 to 35% for the entire society. And what's really important for the work that I and a lot of colleagues do, when we look at that in racial and ethnic and even gender terms, the divide gets even wider. So we see the classic instance where there is considerable asset poverty and income poverty among the white population in the United States, but the pattern is for families of color, the asset poverty line is about three times as high, and the income poverty line is about twice as high. So in addition to the economic income-based axes of inequality in the United States, it's been sort of at the core of my understanding about what America is about and how the challenges of getting ahead for different groups and for everybody in the society is to look at families' wealth profile, because that's their moving ahead money. And when we look at that, the racial and the ethnic divide it's much broader than it is. It's a much wider gap than when we look at income just by itself.
I had interviewed you and your colleague, Dr. Melvin Oliver, when Black Wealth, White Wealth was first published in 1995.
That's a long time ago.
You revealed that almost 70%, I believe the figure was something like 67.3% or so, of African Americans said to be middle class had zero assets. In the almost two decades since the book has been out, and I know you have updated it since, has this picture changed, and what accounts for this extraordinary imbalance?
Let's start with the with thinking about that, why that might be the case, before we bring the data up to date a little bit more from the mid 90s up until now. First, wealth is very different from income in the ways that I talked about earlier, but it's also very different in that wealth has the capacity of being passed along from generations to generations. And if we think about how a community or how a family accumulates wealth in the first place, we have to think very seriously about the history of American society that made it easier for some groups and some populations in the United States to accumulate property, to accumulate homes, to accumulate businesses, and to maintain that over long periods of time, while that same history tells us some extremely unfortunate stories of toxic inequality, where groups, African Americans and other families of color and communities of color, were systematically denied those same wealth accumulation opportunities, like home ownership, and that's sort of a classic one to look at. So, in American society, for most middle class families, the equity we have in our home—that is, how much more in value it is worth today than when it was when we first bought it—is by far the largest part of the wealth portfolio of the typical American family. So, When we ask questions about a family's wealth, if you're not very, very wealthy, the good part of that question is sort of what's happened if you're a homeowner, what's happened with that wealth. The Pew Research Foundation, it was a little less than a year ago now, had a brilliant report that analyzed the destruction of wealth in American society as a result of the Great Recession. And what they came up with was that societal-wide, the destruction of wealth in about four very, very short years in historical time terms, in terms of wealth, that's a very short historical period of time, about 25 to 27% of wealth in American society was destroyed. Yet, when we look at, when that report looked at what happened in the Latino community and what happened in the African-American community, the damage is even much deeper and much more devastating. For example, precisely in the African-American community, the destruction of wealth was like 55%. In the Latino community, the destruction of wealth was like a almost unbelievable 61%. Now, if we ask the question, how could that much wealth have been destroyed in such a short period of time, the answer largely goes back to home equity, because the trigger point, and it wasn't the only cause, but the flashpoint, the trigger point of the Great Recession was, as we know, the collapse of housing markets and the bursting of that housing bubble, which years later now has resulted in the destruction of the wealth, of the greatest reserve of wealth of typical American families. And since African Americans and Hispanics came to home ownership later in their lives than the typical white family has, that is, they tend to have bought it much more often in the last 5 to 10 years versus home ownership that goes back longer in white families in the white community, the destruction of wealth was greater. And that's primarily why Hispanics lost about 61% of their wealth and African Americans about 55 to 57% of their wealth.
A curious thing happens when we talk about wealth and African Americans and Latinos and other non-white groups. When we talk about wealth and whites, we talk about assets, that is, what you own. And invariably, when we discuss wealth and African Americans and Latinos, we talk income, what you earn. Has there been a sufficient reconciliation between these two in terms, is there a standard, right across the board standard, by which wealth is measured?
There is a standard, more or less a standard metric about what comprises wealth, just as there is a much clearer standard metric about what comprises income. It's really been the heart of one of my public projects for the last 20 years or so now, to raise the dialogue and the conversation about families' assets and liabilities, a family's wealth, to the same level that we have public understanding about family income. And that's a very tough challenge, but I think, you know, sitting here today in almost late 2012, you do not read, it's very rare, I won't be extreme here, it's very rare you read a serious discussion of poverty or social mobility these days, either in the academic literature or in the public discourse, that wealth does not come up. Now, 10 years ago, it would have been rare to have had that discussion where wealth did in fact come up. So, not me personally, but there are a lot of people, both academics and much more so today, advocates and policy organizations, and a lot of grassroots organizations and constituencies that have a much better handle on what it takes to move ahead and to alleviate poverty for themselves and their community. And that's an understanding about the role that wealth plays in that process. And they're beginning to take that conversation to policymakers.
How do people who are considered working class, middle class, even poor, how do they reconstruct their thinking about assets?
I think it's on the one hand, it's both a slow process, and on the other hand, it's also a very sudden process. So we've been in the field. We've had the great fortune of interviewing nearly 200 families. First, we talked to them in 1998 and 1999, and we're just coming out of the field now, having re-interviewed them 12 to 13 years later. And one of the topics that we talked to them about is their sense of economic security and their sense of retirement. That is, do they have plans for retirement? How have they planned for it? How have they prepared for it? And when we, too often in the sets of interviews, both with African-American families and with white families, when we get to the topic of retirement and economic security, there is almost this very nervous kind of laughter, and it's the kind of laughter that betrays some pretty deep anxieties that, families will tell us, as we hear elsewhere, well, my retirement plan is now that I've got to work 5 years longer. And that's an understanding that whatever they have put aside in addition to Social Security, whatever pension they might have had, whatever savings they might have had, enough of that was destroyed such that they couldn't, that their plan, their thinking about when they could formally retire now had to be put way off. And that, I think, is a pretty harsh measure of that impact. But it also tells us that families have a fairly, on the one hand, a fairly immediate understanding of some pretty deep processes like the Great Recession and how it impacts them personally. Now, the other side of it is the much slower side, about how families can think about accumulating enough financial assets to allow them to make a better life for themselves and their children. And creating and accumulating that kind of wealth is not easy, especially when the income levels are so comparatively low and when they've not been increasing for a long period of time in American society. So it's not easy to say, well, I've got my paycheck, we're going to spend 90% of it on things, on necessities, and we're going to put 10% aside. And when that 10% gets large enough, we're going to invest it in a mutual fund or throw it into a certificate of deposit or whatever investment vehicle you want to do with it. That kind of discretionary money that families earn out of their jobs is simply not there. And that's why the building of wealth is so slow. And that's also why home equity is such a large part of it, because it's what we call a forced savings. There's nothing active people do after buying that house.
How does wealth perpetuate inequality, as you contend?
It does it in a lot of ways. I like to think of this in terms of wealth. Wealth creates simultaneously both tremendous privilege and advantage for those that are fortunate enough to have enough wealth so that that can happen. So what do I mean by it creates privilege and advantages? If we look, for example, at weak public school systems and how families have this great, inspiring aspiration to have their kids become the best they possibly can be, to provide the best kind of educational quality they can have for their children. Taking that aspiration to a plan, to action, when you have financial assets and that kind of advantage and privilege, is something that's at your fingertips. You just have to make that kind of decision if you have enough family wealth to do that. So you can navigate poor urban or rural public school systems by sending your child or your children to private school, for example. You can, we know the social science community is highly confirmed, and it's virtually uncontested these days, that there's a very straight correlation for the most part between high quality, high test scoring school districts and the wealth of that community. So getting to a high-quality school system, if you can't pay for it by private schooling, is also relatively unattainable. What you have to do is you've got to buy a home in that wealthy community that then provides you access to a quote-unquote public school system. So in the educational sphere, and that's just one area, but it's a pretty important one in American society, in the educational sphere, we see the daily working out in the lived experience of advantage and privilege, in the greater quality and the chances that it can buy for those that have that. Now, I've got a colleague that talks about wealth. When he talks about it as surplus security. And what he means by that is that those that are fortunate enough to have enough financial assets and wealth, one of the things that it does is that it provides a great buffer against risks and the failure that might come from risks. So wealth buys you a second chance. It buys you a third chance. It buys you a fourth chance. And if you have sufficient wealth, there are innumerable chances that it buys for that family and their children as they're growing up. The other side of this coin is that wealth or lack of wealth also passes along disadvantage. And I contend that advantage and disadvantage is a relationship. They're different sides to the same coin, so that a family without substantial financial resources can't buy more than one opportunity for its kid or its child. If it fails, there's not a whole lot other than motivation and what comes from the home and what comes from the heart. There are not a whole lot of other external resources and support systems that family can buy for themselves or their child. They're, if you will, stuck in a weak public school system if that's where they are. And that's what I mean by wealth passing along inequality from generation to generation. What it does is it passes along lack of opportunity and extreme challenges. That doesn't mean people can't make it. It really does mean it's a whole lot harder if you don't have those financial support systems for those that don't. And for those that do, it makes that much less of a challenge. It doesn't guarantee that they're going to succeed. But all being said and done, at the end of the day, I am sure that I'm sure I will, I would, and I'm sure virtually all of our listeners would prefer to have their child in a high-quality school system than in a weak-quality school system.
We're talking about America's Great Economic Divide with our guest, Professor Thomas Shapiro. We'll take your calls after this break at 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. We'll take a short break and come right back to your questions and comments.
Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest is Professor Thomas Shapiro of Brandeis University. We're talking about America's Great Economic Divide. Your calls at 888-874-4888. Professor Shapiro, my question is psychological in nature. When you talk about wealth, of course, people who are living literally clinging to life, day-to-day living is so taxing. People are desperately trying to meet their everyday needs and take care of their families and survive, literally. They don't have time to think about wealth. Wealth is a concept. It's an ethereal thing. It's something that exists in the imagination. But how should communities now begin to think? When you say wealth, I mean, it conjures up, you know, luxury living, and that's not what you're saying. You're saying that wherever you are, whatever state you are in, the potential is there for you to begin to reorganize your thinking and your actions with regard to accumulating something that gives you a cushion against emergencies and the vicissitudes of life. So how do people begin to do that?
That's a great challenge that we and a lot of people have been working on for some considerable time now. I think that the point of understanding to start with is that when I and others talk about wealth, and even when we talk about the racial wealth gap, we're really not talking about those at the very, very top. We're not talking about the billionaire game, if you will, of whomever dies with the most toys wins. No, we have an understanding that, in fact, relatively small amounts of wealth can make great changes in the trajectory, in the lifestyles, in the security of American families. And we're talking about, I don't want to put a number on it, but we're not even talking necessarily about four figures. Less than $10,000, for example, can, depending on the community, is a lot of contingency security, is a lot of security against emergencies. It could even be a pretty good, it can go a long way towards a down payment on a house. It can go a long way towards the start of a business if that's somebody's inclination. It can go a long way for a state university, a community college education. It can go a long way towards reducing the level of debt that families might be on. Now, I didn't mean to light on a $10,000 figure in particular, but I really wanted to try and drive home the larger point that relatively small amounts of wealth can make great changes in the story of a family and in the stories of families in a community. So when we think about the project or the dream becomes not necessarily to make oneself a millionaire, but rather the project and the dream is, what do I need to buy a house if that's really important? What do I need to be able to give action and to give concrete hope to my child's desire to go to college and my ambition to get them to college? And we think about those amounts that are triggered to concrete actions and concrete hopes on the part of families, the psychological difficulty is not nearly as great. The problem then becomes, the challenge becomes, okay, how can I scrimp? How can I be frugal enough? What can I do? What programs exist out there? And there are a lot of them, and we can maybe touch on that momentarily, that can help me get to that place where I can have some money set aside, not just to pay the light bill or the heating bill in the dead of winter, but also to pay for, half a year of community college for my daughter who may go there in 2 years. That's a good starting point.
All right, you walk us through. I'm re-listening.
Got you bought in?
Yeah, we're listening.
Okay. So there have been proposals at the federal level. There have been proposals at the state level, some of which have actually gone far along now. And there are actual programs in some municipalities like San Francisco around something that we call the Children's Savings Account, where the entire idea is to begin to build a nest egg of financial security and savings and wealth to be able to begin to pay tuition for, so that college becomes affordable, and or so that the debt of that child's of 2 or 4 years of college is not as great as it might be without that kind of tuition help. In San Francisco, for example, and as the programs are designed elsewhere, the designs differ a bit. Because it's all pilot and we're experimenting, we're trying to figure out what works best, what meets families' needs best, what the public will buy into, and all those sorts of policy design questions. But in places like San Francisco, every child in kindergarten in the public school system in San Francisco has established a savings account in their or their parents' name that is designed, first of all, for their future educational enrichment or needs. And that account can be added to every year, and parents can match it. Now, I believe, I'm not sure about San Francisco, but elsewhere, the policy design of those children's savings accounts are progressive, meaning that a private entity, whether it's philanthropic, or a public entity, whether it's a city, state, or federal government, will match the contributions that a parent makes to their children's savings account. So that over a period of 12 years, even if we wait and start that at age 5 in kindergarten, we could actually start them when the child is born. That's a different set of proposals. By the end of 12 years, a yearly contributions that may or may not be matched, compounded interest, those kinds of accounts can be large enough to afford close to 2 years of your average state or community college. And I think that's a great start. So that's what I would suggest would be one priority. A second priority would be greater understanding and going to scale, and by that I mean meeting the needs of all those that are really eligible, of a current program out of the federal government that's known as individual development accounts. That's a set of programs that provide a highly structured set of incentives for low to moderate income families to save money that is matched. And it's matched by money that literally comes out of the federal government. It's a pretty small budget. You know, I don't want to sort of ring that bell too loudly. I'd like to be able to ring it much more loudly in the future if that program grew to be to get to scale of all those that might be eligible. But that program has been on the ground long enough that we're able to evaluate the results, which are not just promising; they've been proven, and it's been proven that poor families will, in fact, save when given the right kinds of structures and the right kind of guidance and the right kind of mentoring. And there is no question about that anymore. 15 to 20 years ago, economists would be blowing up your phone line saying, no, we know it's impossible for poor people and poor families to save. That's no longer the case. That's been proven in real life in the field with real programs. So even designed specifically for the kinds of families that I think you and I have in our minds that are just barely getting by, where we think savings is an extremely difficult act, which it is, we have figured out ways through behavioral economics and through structures that allow those families to put money aside. And there are some incredibly inspiring success stories about families buying their first homes, about families sending their young children to school and now to college, about even starting small businesses. Now, those programs are, because they're federally financed, they're highly restrictive. And they're highly restricted in that families can only use it for higher educational purposes, for growing or starting a business, for retirement.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that at a time when America was at its most segregated, it seemed that the people today who are classified as poor, or who would be classified as poor, were quite self-sufficient and self-sustaining. In other words, it seems ironic that desegregation created a certain kind of dependency or poverty itself.
It changed the rules of the game a bit. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But I think it's interesting. Interesting is a too neutral of a term here. I think it's actually quite harmful that the only people in the United States that we ask to be self-sufficient are those low and moderate income families. Virtually, I would make the case, virtually nobody in the United States is quote-unquote self-sufficient. We all depend to a large extent on our living standard for the way that, for example, the tax code treats home ownership. It allows people to deduct from the taxes the interest that they pay on their mortgages. Those aren't poor families. It allows families who are putting money aside for their retirement to shield that from taxes so that the rest of us have to make that up. Those families, you know, and I'm included in that, we are not self-sufficient in that way. It is just sort of a much more hidden part. It can't get demonized as a handout in the same way that we have way too often characterize low to moderate income families and the needs they have of and the support they get from a state, a local, or a federal government.
Well, Professor Shapiro, thank you so much. This was quite illuminating, and I'm sure we'll be connecting with each other again very soon as you take a look at the census figures more deeply and deconstruct them for us.
I very much look forward to that. In fact, in mid-October, we're launching a very important report on why the racial wealth gap has grown over the last 25 years. And I hope people look forward to that. And thank you very much for allowing me to talk to you and your listeners today.
Thank you so much. This is Lead Stories. You can reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. And, of course, coming up right behind me is another new member of the PRN family, and that is Dr. Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. So I just want to extend him the same warm welcome as was extended to me here at PRN. And I know, based on what I've been listening to in his interview with Gary Null, I think it's going to be a fantastic program full of information. I want to thank you again, always, for your letters and your notes and your emails. I want to thank you for listening, but I want you to take on a task. The task is to grow this family, and by that I mean that come 1 o'clock every day, we have a huge gathering. We're growing, and I'm glad for that, but I need your help as well to continue growing this family, to attract more and more people so that when the program is done, you have the ability to follow through, you can talk, you can continue the conversation, and you can continue exchanging ideas. So it's a wonderful aspect to doing radio. You get to continue the ideas as you go along. So do make an effort. If you can, pass the word, get the word out to people in your circle, those people in your spheres of influence, as it were. Pass the word to them. Let them know that this is where you come every day. And especially, I want to be a little bit selfish, right here at 1 o'clock and continue for the rest of the day, of course. So thank you for that. I also want to let you know that tomorrow we will have Think Tank Thursday, where we have the emphasis will be on conversations. We'll be throwing ideas around and be prepared to be challenged tomorrow, because that's an exercise too. You would have picked up so far a theme of mine, which is it is not enough simply to say what you're against. You know, there are warehouses filled with things that people are against. We're interested in what you're thinking about as a solution. What is your response? And what have you invested in that response? We want to get those ideas as considered opinions that you can present for public inspection and debate. So tomorrow, bring your best game, because I'm going to be on you. The phone lines are going to be open for Think Tank Thursday, and we'll be talking about the issues of the day from your perspective. So once again, thank you. I'm ending so that we can get the more messages in and get ready for Dr. Jack Rasmus and Alternative Visions. Thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. And again, Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Bye-bye.
God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own. Rich relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
God bless the child.